6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
Today is Tuesday, April 9th, and you're listening to A Public Affair. I'm your host, Anjali Brecky, and today we will be talking about conflict on the Korean Peninsula. In their article, Lurching Towards War, A Postmortem on Strategic Patience, Hyun Lee and Christine Hong write, "The escalation of military threats and tension on and around the Korean Peninsula point to a resurgence of war as a plausible scenario involving the same national actors and international alliances central to the Korean War, the United States and South Korea on the one hand, and North Korea and China on the other. In U.S. media, all blame has gone to North Korea, which U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel describes as a clear and present danger. The facts suggest otherwise. In addition to the bombers, the ships, and the stealth fighters that it has recently deployed to the region, the United States has quietly intensified the danger of war on the Korean Peninsula. Jointly with South Korea, it has openly exercised O-Plan 5029, a U.S. war plan that simulates regime collapse in and U.S. occupation of North Korea." We will be talking to the authors of this article to gain insight into the raised tensions surrounding the conflict. For the first half of the hour, we will be speaking with Hyun Lee. She is a member of the Working Group of Peace and Demilitarization in Asia and the Pacific, as well as the National Campaign to End the Korean War. She also co-hosts Asian Pacific Forum, a weekly radio show on culture and politics of Asia and the Asian diaspora. Welcome to A Public Affair.
Hi, Anjali.
Hello. So my first question has to do with contextualizing the situation. How did the Korean Peninsula split in two, and what was Korea like before the Korean War?
Yes, that's a good question. Korea, before the Korean War, was colonized by Japan for 35 years, from 1910 to 1945. After World War II, Japan surrendered and started to withdraw from South Korea. Obviously, before that, there was a mass independence, national independence movement that was very strong in South Korea. And after the withdrawal, Koreans were preparing for autonomous self-rule. And then, unfortunately, in 1948, Korea was divided by the superpowers at the time. That's the Soviet Union and the United States. And the United States basically installed a puppet regime through a man named Syng Man Rhee, who ruled southern part of Korea during and after the Korean War. And as we know, the Korean War broke out in 1950. 3 years later, the United States and North Korea signed an armistice, which was a temporary ceasefire to stop the war, but it was never replaced with a peace treaty. And here we are, 60 years later. This year, actually, is the 50th anniversary of the armistice signing. And threats of war are escalating every day on the Korean Peninsula. And unfortunately, that is the unfortunate consequence of not having turned the armistice into a peace treaty.
And what were the casualties during the Korean War?
4 million people dead. And, you know, a lot of people don't know, but Bruce Cummings, who is a historian who has written extensively about the Korean War based on declassified U.S. documents, and he talks about basically 99% of North Korea, the infrastructure in North Korea, was carpet bombed by the United States.
Wow. And could you go over the recent timeline of North Korean threats and the responses from the U.S. and South Korea?
Ah, yes. Well, you know, something happened last July that the Western media paid no attention to, but I think was pretty significant, which is that the DPRK, the North Korean Foreign Ministry, issued a memo. And in this memo, North Korea announced, "We have basically reviewed the past 20 years of our negotiations with the United States and come to the conclusion that they have failed." Hmm. The principle of action. Action for Action, which is an agreement that was agreed on through the six-part talks, that both parties will act simultaneously as a measure of confidence building. They said in this memo, Action for Action is no longer working, and we are now no longer interested in empty talk. We're not interested in talks at all unless the United States acts first to demonstrate its sincerity that it is willing to fundamentally change its policy towards North Korea, meaning that the United States will no longer consider it an enemy state and try to, you know, bring about the collapse of the North Korean regime. And a few weeks after this memo was issued, Kim Jong-un, the new leader of North Korea, gave a speech at a banquet and basically said, basically referring to Obama's policy of strategic patience, Kim Jong-un declared, our patience has limits, and he called for a nationwide preparation for all-out war. They're calling it the Great War for National Unification. Mm-hmm. And since then, until now, you know, that's what's been happening in North Korea, is they have been preparing for war. Now, in the West and also in South Korea, as you mentioned in the earlier broadcast of the, you know, the latest update in Korea, many people downplay North Korea's threats and say, you know, this is, they're not serious about going to war, and this is more to get concessions. And I think it's understandable why many people come to this conclusion, because for a tiny little country like North Korea to threaten war against the most militarized country in the world, the United States, that it is willing to go to war, it sounds preposterous. It sounds inconceivable that North Korea would start a war against the United States. But I think we need to understand what, from the DPRK's perspective, what they see. And basically what they see is that the United States, as you mentioned in your intro, for the past few years, has really been intensifying war threats on the Korean Peninsula and has been preparing for the collapse of the North Korean regime. And what North Korea is saying is, we're not going to wait passively until that happens, and until we're going to be wiped out. We're going to take the offensive. So I think basically that's what's going on.
And you mentioned something earlier called the U.S. strategy of strategic patience, which you mentioned in your article. Could you explain this term for our audience?
This is a term that's used to describe Obama's policy towards North Korea in his first term. And what does it really mean? Patience for what? What are they waiting for? Well, when Obama took office in 2008, it was right after the former leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, had a stroke. And he disappeared from public activities for a while. He wasn't seen on North Korean state media. And so this kind of led experts in South Korea and Washington to now start to speculate that the North Korean leader's death is imminent, and that the regime would collapse as soon as he died. And so what the Pentagon started doing is developing what you mentioned earlier, Operation Plan 5029, and openly exercising it as part of their annual war games. Mm. And what this Operation Plan does is, it's an unconventional war plan, because the United States does not want a frontal war. This plan is basically a response to five or six potential scenarios that people imagine in which the North Korean regime would collapse. And so it includes things like the outflow of nuclear weapons and a civil war resulting from a regime collapse after Kim Jong-il's death, and as well as a large-scale natural disaster that creates large-scale defection of North Korean residents to bordering countries. So, you know, it outlines all these different scenarios, and then the plan is basically how will the South Korean and U.S. militaries respond in this situation. And it's a step-by-step plan of how U.S. forces with South Korean forces will enter North Korea and basically collapse the regime and occupy North Korea, and then reorganize the North Korean state under South Korean leadership, meaning this would be a kind of a reunification that is South Korean-led absorption of North Korea. Basically, what strategic patience refers to is wait for the eventual collapse of the North Korean regime and prepare for that scenario. And in the meantime, there has been no formal talks between North Korea and the United States. And again, you know, obviously when there are no talks, there is actually a greater risk of miscalculation and misunderstanding on all sides. The United States has very little read of what North Korea wants at this point. Why are they behaving this way? Because there has been no talks. And then, as we know now, in 2011, Kim Jong-il did die. However, they defied all Western predictions, and the regime did not collapse. And so since then, we have seen the United States with South Korea basically intensifying war threats on the Korean Peninsula, and then also intensifying sanctions so that they can basically isolate the regime and bring about its collapse.
And have sanctions against North Korea been effective at all in changing anything?
Well, I mean, North Korea is probably the most sanctioned country in the world. Sanctions against North Korea began in 1950, in the beginning of the Korean War, by Truman. And since then, the United States has basically developed a very complex system of sanctions on all transactions, on financial transactions, and trade in North Korea. And it has not been effective if the aim is to bring about the collapse of the regime, because 60 years of sanctions and the regime is still there. But where it has really hurt North Korea is in the lives of ordinary people, because when we look at the list of things that are prohibited from entering North Korea because it's considered dual use, meaning that it could also be used for military purposes, are things like blood transfusion bags, things like syringes, water purification systems. These are all things that are necessary for the basic health and livelihoods of the people. And I think North Korea definitely feels it on that end, which is why North Korea feels that it's all the more imperative for it to end this 60-year-old conflict that has really isolated the country and has kind of prevented them from being able to develop economically.
And I would like to remind our listeners that you're listening to A Public Affair. I'm your host, Anjali Brekke, and today we're speaking with Hyun Lee about North Korea. And we have a caller for you. Caller, you are on the air. Please state your name and question.
Yeah, I wanted to just touch on something. The last couple of years of the Clinton administration, there was a rapprochement beginning between the two Koreas, and you had for the first time in like 50 years families actually being able to meet each other. And then the very first thing that the George Bush administration did in February of 2001 was to scuttle that and to basically break that down so that the situation that we have today is really a product of what George Bush did rather than, I think, the whole history of the U.S. And the Korean War. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. 2 points on that. One, I want to read you a quote by a man named Jeffrey Bader. He was the senior director for East Asian Affairs at the White House National Security Council in Obama's first term, and he's largely known as the architect of the Obama administration's policy on the Korean Peninsula. And he wrote a book called Obama and China's Rise. And in there, he writes about U.S. intentions vis-a-vis North Korea, and he says, many of us believed that the most likely long-term solution to the North's nuclear pursuit lay in the North's collapse and the absorption into a South-led reunified Korea. At the same time, he says, a strategy was still needed to slow down, freeze, and degrade the North Korean program until history could take its course. So, in two very concise sentences, basically what he does is summarize 20 years of U.S. policy towards North Korea, which is basically delay their nuclear program until the eventual collapse of his regime. So, that has been the thrust of U.S. policy, whether it's in Clinton's administration or Bush's administration and now Obama. But you're right to point out that there was a period at the tail end of Bush's administration where the United States did an about-face in their policy. In both, actually, you talked about Clinton administration, but actually in both Clinton and Bush's administration, at the end of their administration, after many years of negotiating with the North Koreans, both of them came to the realization that, or came to the conclusion that the best course vis-a-vis North Korea is normalization. So, as you mentioned, in 2000, at the end of Clinton's administration, State Secretary Albright went to Pyongyang, and that led to the joint communique between North Korea and the United States. North Korea said, we will halt our nuclear program. The United States said, we will give you security assurance and our pledge to normalize relations. And then, as you mentioned, Bush came in completely through all agreements reached by Clinton out the window. But then at the end of his administration, State Secretary Rice again brokered a deal where the United States took North Korea off the list of state sponsors of terrorism, and then North Korea blew up their cooling tower at their nuclear power plant in Yeongbyon. Unfortunately, what happened is that both administrations ran out of time to implement these agreements, and then every time a new administration came into office, negotiations went back to square one, and Obama did not pick up where Bush left off or Clinton left off. And I think one thing that could be different this time around is that State Secretary Kerry can change this pattern by learning the lessons of past administrations earlier in the Obama administration and brokering a peace process that gets us out of the current crisis.
And we have one more caller for you. Caller, you're on the air. Please state your name and question.
Thank you. I was in the Army when the shooting was going on. That is the U.S. Army in Korea. I'm very fortunate. One, I didn't ever have to go to Korea. And two, they stopped shooting and had an armistice, and then later a peace treaty. I guess we're still at war. But they did stop shooting shortly after I got into the Army, so I breathed a lot easier. But it took a book by I.F. Stone called The Hidden History of the Korean War, and his theory was simple, that we suckered, us and our allies, whoever they might have been in Korea, suckered the North into attack. I'm a benefit receiver of a Korean vet, even though I didn't have to go to Korea, but I was in the service at that time. My question to you is, what was in it for us? I can barely understand what the people in Washington wanted during the Cold War. That's one thing. But what now? It seems totally insane. But this I do know, and I remember this specifically, that every time the two Koreas seemed like they were going to have a rapprochement and maybe unite, the Americans interfered and the rapprochement got canceled. And that goes on till today, whether or not the nutcase in charge attacks us, which I don't think he's going to do. I mean, why would he want to commit suicide for his whole nation? Thank you very much for the program.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Well, first, you know, let me commend you because the Korean War was a long time ago and you sound very healthy. So, you know, that's really great. Your question about what's in it for the United States, why does it want to collapse this tiny little regime, you know, tiny little speck on the Asian continent? And what's in it for the United States? I think that's a really good question. And I think for that we have to look at what are the United States' broader interests in that region, in the Asia-Pacific region. And I want to read you one other quote by a man maybe you're familiar with. He is the former, actually I do not have that quote with me, but he is the former commander of U.S. forces in Korea. His name is B.B. Bell, and he was interviewed in a magazine called Joint Forces Quarterly several years back on the question of why do we still need U.S. troops in South Korea so many years after the Cold War. And his answer was, look, 25% of global trade goes through my region, and the United States depends on a peaceful and secure world for capital to flow. And we are here because we're protecting those interests. That's why it's important for us to be here. That was his answer. And, you know, we may be aware that a couple years ago, President Obama announced what people are now referring to as the pivot to Asia, meaning, you know, the United States is suffering from a global economic recession. They look across the Pacific and see this vast continent that is full of promise, rich in resources, huge market, cheap labor. And the United States wants to make sure that it is leading the process of economic integration in that region, as opposed to China. And so it's been increasing its naval presence in the region to control the sea lanes, the trade routes. And like General B.B. Bell said, what they want in this region is a quote-unquote peaceful and secure place for commerce, for capital to flow in and out. Now, when they see North Korea, they see this country as a quagmire, as a threat to peace and security for capital flow. And you know, the pattern of U.S. actions for dealing with such quagmires in the Middle East in the past has been to actively intervene, collapse regimes, and occupy. And North Korea, looking at the broader context, has very little to believe, has very little reason to believe that it's not in U.S. crosshairs. And so it's in that context that North Korea recently announced we are now nullifying the armistice and we are ready to fight because, and knowing that the United States does not want a frontal war. The U.S. has been preparing for unconventional war, for regime change and occupation. They do not want to risk a frontal war because this would be a disaster for their force posture in the region. So that's where we are.
Thank you so much. And thank you. I know you have to get going, but I would like to thank you for being on A Public Affair.
Thank you very much.
And we've been speaking with Hyun Lee. She is a member of the Working Group of Peace on Peace and Demilitarization in Asia and the Pacific, as well as the National Campaign to End the Korean War. We will be speaking for the second half of the hour with Christine Hong. Both of these women are authors of Lurching Towards War, A Postmortem on Strategic Patience. Hello, and we are back on A Public Affair. I'm your host, Anjali Brecky, and today we are speaking with Christine Hong about North Korea. We just listened to the song There's Peace in Korea, performed by Sister Rosetta Tharpe in 1953 after the supposed end to the Korean War. The conflict, however, persists to the present. Our guest for the second half of the hour is Christine Hong, professor at the University of California in Santa Cruz and co-author of the article Lurching Towards War, A Postmortem on Strategic Patience. Hello, Christine, and welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you, Anjali.
And my first question is, at the start of his first term, Obama discussed his willingness to extend a hand if America's foes were willing to unclench their fists. In your opinion, has Obama made a serious attempt at diplomacy with North Korea?
You know, not at all. Actually, not at all. You know, we could actually give a comparison and say that George W. Bush, who labeled North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil, made more strides toward the normalization of U.S. relations with North Korea during late in his second term than Obama has yet to do. And as you mentioned, you know, he came in with an inaugural promise that, unlike his hardline neoconservative predecessor, he would be willing to discover those pathways to peace that had not yet been tried. And so, I mean, this was, of course, you know, welcome news to many Americans who are absolutely sick of war. And I think it's very interesting that, you know, this sort of national security subset of people whom we call Korea watchers, they tend to read the prognostications of North Korean leadership very carefully, like they're reading tea leaves, and they tend to focus on the New Year's pronouncements of the North Korean leadership. And when Obama came into office, I think it's important to realize that Kim Jong-il tailored his New Year's statement to indicate that Pyongyang was ready and willing to enter into a peace process with the United States. What we had during Obama's first term was a policy called strategic patience. That is what his advisors called it. And many policy analysts make the mistake of thinking that this is a passive policy, or it's a wait-and-see or a do-nothing policy. In point of fact, strategic patience does mean that Obama did not seriously engage with North Korea during the entirety of his first term as president. But we have to look at the other aspect of Obama's policy within the region and the role that North Korea plays in justifying U.S. policy within the region. And so Obama has another policy. It's the major foreign policy shift of his presidency, and it's what Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, and Leon Panetta, former Secretary of Defense, called America's pivot to Asia and the Pacific. And what this pivot policy entailed was a reallocation of military resources and forces away from the Middle East and away from Europe to Asia and the Pacific. And when you read Hillary Clinton's articles and pronouncements about this, you realize that the reason is that she and the administration view Asia to be America's economic future. And what she states in this article is that the United States is going to use an existing military infrastructure and reanimate that, what Chalmers Johnson called an empire of bases, as a way of securing U.S. dominance, if not hegemony, in the region. And the clear object which the United States wishes to contain is China, not North Korea, but China. But, you know, I mean, that goes back to Obama's North Korea policy. You know, you hear all of this, you know, ruckus and this jingoism in the media right now that feels very much like the media walking in lockstep with administration toward potential war with North Korea. And, you know, what you, you know, so, I mean, it's a very terrifying time right now. And what we don't realize is that North Korea furnishes a very convenient pretext for the U.S. to have a forward deployed presence in the region. And whenever the U.S. conducts these massive war games, exercises, and what have you, the intended audience is not just North Korea, whom the United States deems to be a threat, even though the U.S. vastly outmatches North Korea in terms of military power. The intended audience is China.
And we have a caller for you. Caller, you're on the air. Please state your name and question.
Yeah, hello. My name is Methuselah. My questions are this. Could you discuss the factors that led to the beginning of the hostilities in Korea in 1950? I've heard versions that say that it was in response to repressive action against communists in the South under the regime of Syngman Rhee. And my second question, could you explain the reasons why North Korea did such blatantly unacceptable things as kidnapping innocent civilians and abducting them to North Korea so they could be supposedly used for intelligence purposes. And I'll take my answers to those questions off the air, and thanks for taking the call.
Thank you, caller. Your response, Christine?
So thanks, Methuselah, for those questions. I guess I'd say your first question has to do with a question that has bedeviled Korean studies for many decades, which is the origins of the Korean War. And if you think about Korea's situation, I think that we have to understand the history, which is that Korea is a divided country. But why? You know, Korea was a colony of Japan throughout the Pacific War, throughout World War II, and yet it suffered a fate akin to an aggressor during World War II, namely Germany. So the question is, you know, why did Korea suffer division? Japan did not. And, you know, and who divided Korea? Well, just 3 days after the bombing of Nagasaki, two junior army officers, Dean Rusk and Charles Bonnesfield, retired to a room armed with a National Geographic map of Korea. With absolutely zero Korean input, they divided the peninsula in two, into two occupation zones, one Soviet, the other U.S. And this, you know, Soviets eventually acceded to this, but they had no say in this decision. And so the U.S. was planning at this time for its own Cold War sphere of influence within the Asia-Pacific region. Devil may care what Koreans themselves thought about a foreign power dividing the country. As eminent historian at the University of Chicago, Bruce Cummings says, South Korea in the first instance was a U.S. creation. Unlike Kim Il-sung, who was an anti-colonial guerrilla fighter who had a long history of fighting against the Japanese occupiers in Manchuria, the leader that the U.S. erected and supported and installed in the South was Syngman Rhee. He was someone who would have had zero popular support, or very insignificant popular support, certainly not enough to clinch for him the presidency of South Korea. So when you speak about the hostilities in 1950, you have to realize that by drawing a border through the Korean Peninsula, a sort of occupation line through the Korean Peninsula, the United States ensured that there would be a civil war aimed at national reunification that would be fought by both sides. And it's a sad truth that in the South, far from being anti-colonial under U.S. governance, the U.S. propped up Syngman Rhee, and his cabinet and administration was populated by Koreans who had collaborated with the Japanese colonial power during the Japanese colonial period. So the U.S. basically triggered a very devastating war. And at mid-century, I would just also add that the U.S. owned the skies over the Korean Peninsula. Then, as is the case today, the U.S. was militarily superior in every single which way, and it fought an asymmetrical war. And I think it's very sobering to realize that all of North Korea was understood as a target for U.S. air power. And, you know, the total deaths that North Korea suffered were 3.5 million people, 70% of whom were civilians. So I think that that's important backdrop for understanding how the ongoing Korean War, which was never resolved with a peace treaty, persists as the basis of relations between the U.S. and North Korea. North Korea has asked the United States multiple times for a peace treaty. The U.S. has always seen it in its interests to deny that request. You asked another question, which is why North Korea does blatantly unacceptable things such as kidnapping innocent civilians, and I'm assuming that you mean the Japanese, the handful of Japanese citizens who were kidnapped by North Korea. I think that it's very interesting to realize that every single government in the world does dirty business. you think about what the United States has done in terms of CIA activity around the world, that's a very ugly record. When you think about what Japan did to its neighbors, that is a hideous record. And what's interesting about North Korea is that when Koizumi visited North Korea and met with Kim Jong-il, much to his surprise, Kim Jong-il actually admitted that North Korea kidnapped these civilians. So rather than, say, exceptionalize North Korea for doing dirty business, I think that what's exceptional is actually that North Korea admitted that it did.
And when we look at relations between North Korea and South Korea, how did the histories of these two nations diverge after the Korean War into their present-day state?
You know, I guess I would say this. You have two societies that are cultivated and consolidated during the Cold War. And, you know, there's a scholar named Paeknak Chung who describes the Korean context as a kind of division system. There are other division systems around the world, but this is one that has a kind of unique Cold War nature. And I think that it's very interesting that the way that we tend to describe North and South, we rely upon a very easy, very facile shorthand. We describe North Korea as unfree, as communist, as dictatorial, all these kinds of things that, to, I think, the sort of, you know, sort of commonplace, like American sort of public sense of things, North Korea just seems like a kind of aberration. In contrast, we tout South Korea as a thriving capitalist democracy. But I think that if we scratch below the surface, we realize that in the South, the U.S. policy was to prop up one military dictator after another. In the first instance, the government in the South was the U.S. military government. It was not the South Korean government per se. It was the U.S. military government which gave rise to a U.S.-sponsored dictator, Syngman Rhee. And so the U.S. propped up a series and backed a series of military dictators in the South, and all the while, South Korean people were fighting for democracy. So you had massive democracy movements in South Korea led by students and labor. And in 1980, there was a spectacular clash. The United States has command control over the South Korean military. South Korea is semi-sovereign under U.S. military hegemony. And what happened was the United States, it was the Carter administration, authorized the South Korean military to strike against civilian protesters who were fighting for democracy. And the South Korean military killed thousands of civilians. And so you realize that the slow march to democracy did not happen because the U.S. fostered it. It happened despite U.S. intervention. And it was U.S. intervention that supported right-wing dictators.
Wow. And when we look at modern-day powers in North and South Korea, North Korea and both South Korea have new leadership. How does this affect relations today?
You know, Bruce Cummings, the historian I mentioned before, says something very interesting about the regional configuration of leadership. If you look at East Asia, you realize that the leaders of Japan, North Korea, and South Korea all have genealogical ties to ancestors who fought in Manchukuo, which is present-day Manchuria, but during the Japanese colonial period was a territory of Imperial Japan. And so you have Park Geun-hye in South Korea, who was the daughter of right-wing military dictator Park Chung-hee, who was himself a member of the Japan-sponsored Kwantung Army in Manchuria, or Manchukuo, whose purpose was to rout out anti-colonial guerrilla fighters like Kim Il-sung. In North Korea, we have the grandson of an anti-colonial guerrilla fighter, Kim Il-sung, in Kim Jong-un. And Kim Il-sung, his testing ground as a fighter was in Manchukuo against the Japanese colonial powers. And then over in Japan, we have Abe Shinzo. Abe Shinzo's grandfather was a Class A war criminal who ran a munitions factory in Manchukuo. And so you have, and he himself, Abe Shinzo, is a denier that of Japanese war crimes against the Korean people, in particular the sexual enslavement of Korean women in the so-called comfort system. And so you have this kind of very strange configuration of power. But I think that one thing that does bode well, and I think that this is something that people should take stock of, you know, with all the sort of hoopla in the media and the attempt to describe North Korea as singularly committing provocations, and the United States, the world's largest purveyor of military violence, simply responding to North Korea's threats, I think that we have to take a step back and actually think about other possible places where this kind of very tight, vice-like tight situation, this hair-trigger dangerous situation, might be relaxed. And, you know, I'd say a couple of things. One is that that Kim Jong-un, everyone acknowledges it would be suicidal for North Korea to launch a first attack against the United States. And one thing that South Korean scholars have noted, and scholars in South Korea have noted, is that the U.S. media has chopped off North Korea's pronouncement so that something that ensues from the North Korean government along the lines of, if the U.S. strikes first, we will not hesitate to retaliate. Or if the U.S. strikes, we will then strike Guam, Hawaii, and the west coast of the United States. And what these South Korean scholars have noted is that in the Western press, the if clause is chopped off, and all that is transmitted is the clause, we will strike the United States. And so I think, you know, I don't think that we are in any danger of being attacked by North Korea. I think that there is far more of a chance that the U.S. will strike North Korea, or South Korea will strike North Korea, than the other way around. And what I'd say is that with regard to the sort of like the message landscape, we have to realize that Kim Jong-un sent a message through a sort of unusual envoy, and that was Dennis Rodman. And however unusual the form of the message, I think his message was important. He said that he wanted Dennis Rodman to convey to the White House, and the White House has refused to receive this message, his words, which were, President Obama, we North Koreans do not want war. Please call us. And so he was saying, we want a pathway to peace, and we want negotiations. And, you know, the White House said this is a very sort of irregular, this is a very irregular message. It was not standard formal diplomacy, and it wouldn't receive the message. But Donald Gregg, who was the former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, and Franklin Graham, who was the son of Billy Graham, and also the head of a humanitarian relief organization that delivers food aid to North Korea, both of them said that the content of this message was very serious and that it needed to be heeded.
And I'd like to remind our listeners that you're listening to A Public Affair. I'm your host, Anjali Brecki, and today we're speaking with Christine Hong about North Korea. And I'd like to ask you a question about North Korea and China's relationship. China has been a longstanding ally of North Korea, but Xi Jinping, China's new president, said recently that no country in Asia should be allowed to throw a region and even the world into chaos for selfish gain. Do you think China was referring to North Korea in this, or do you think Xi Jinping was referring to China, or to North Korea, sorry, in this statement? And although China is a longtime ally of North Korea, it also has strong interests in regional stability. What does China see as its role in the conflict?
You know, we have to recall that the U.S., since Kim Jong-il died, the U.S. and South Korea have formulated a policy that is predicated upon the heightened vulnerability of North Korea and the likelihood that regime collapse could be an achievable policy. And so, you know, in the past couple of years, what we have seen is a kind of war games on steroids. It's true, as many people in the Department of Defense say, that we have annual war exercises with our ally South Korea. And but, you know, it's sobering to realize that last year, these exercises actually enacted OPLAN 5029, which is a regime collapse scenario of North Korea that entails U.S. and South Korea joint occupation of the North. These war games also, as you could see with the recent B-2 stealth bomber sortie over the Korean Peninsula, simulate a nuclear first strike against North Korea. You know, when Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel was asked whether or not such actions were destabilizing for the region and provocative, he said, no, they're not provocative. And so, you know, but I think that from the perspective of North Korea and certainly from the perspective of China, these activities are not, they're not simply neutral or containment activities. They are a message of U.S. military might. In fact, the Department of Defense described these kinds of activities as part of its playbook, its sort of theater of war games that it's enacting within the region, flexing its muscle in order to massage the way for its military pivot to Asia and the Pacific. The United States has also transferred mine-resistant armored vehicles that were used in Afghanistan and Iraq to the DMZ. It increased last year South Korea's ballistic missile range so that South Korea could strike North Korea if necessary, and it announced the completion of the Super Bunker Buster program for use against North Korea, as well as transferred a number of leading commanders from its Iraq and Afghanistan theaters of war to Korea. And so all of this has been going on, and it's also given discretionary authority to South Korean local military commanders to strike first and report later. And so that was a recent secret, not-so-secret agreement that was brokered between the U.S. and South Korea within recent weeks. And so when China very obliquely says that it will not tolerate troublemakers who seek their own selfish ends within the region, a lot of the Western media assumed that that China was simply referring to North Korea. But the AP report very interestingly pointed out that there was ambiguity and that the statement could be interpreted to mean the United States. So I think it's very interesting to realize that, of course, China doesn't want North Korea's regime to collapse. As many commentators have stated, China doesn't want a Korea that is, you know, a sort of semi-sovereign, a client state of the United States on its doorstep. And it definitely doesn't want North Korean nuclear power to fall into South Korean hands. So I think, and it doesn't want refugees overflowing its borders. But, you know, what was reported in the Russian media, in the Iranian media, as well as some U.S. media, was the fact that China recently has been clustering its military forces and some of its resources along the North Korea-China border. And in a kind of mirroring of the massive, much bigger, much larger, and much more forceful war games that the U.S. and South Korea have been conducting in around the Korean Peninsula, China actually conducted its own live fire drills in the West Sea. And I think that that is one of the reasons why last week on Thursday, the Department of Defense decided to suspend its playbook of war games, and including, like, you know, missile tests and what have you, because things have gotten hair-triggered dangerous. The received narrative is that we can't predict what North Korea is going to do. But I also think that the United States wasn't entirely prepared for a militarized Chinese response.
And we have just a couple minutes left in the program, but as a last question, what advice would you give President Obama regarding policy towards North Korea?
I would join in the chorus of so many people who have said, make good on your inaugural promise. North Korea is a ready and willing partner in a peace process, and so many of U.S. policy aims within the region would be far more achievable if President Obama were to pursue a very clear pathway toward peace. This would mean potentially having to recognize North Korea as a de facto nuclear power. But I say that the alternative is unthinkable. If right now we're on a crash course to the possibility of the U.S. committing a nuclear first strike against North Korea in order to denuclearize it, that would be as disastrous of a policy of deploying weapons of mass destruction against Iraq to prevent it from cultivating them. And I definitely don't think that President Obama wants to have the decimation of the Korean Peninsula as part of his foreign policy legacy.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being on A Public Affair. We've been speaking with Hyun Lee and Christine Hong about their article, Lurching Towards War, A Postmortem on Strategic Patience. Thank you so much for tuning in.